I'm Emily Alphen Johnson, VPR Digital Producer. Your time is valuable, so we've edited this episode for clarity and brevity.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. When a 19-year-old allegedly shot and killed 17 people in a high school in Florida last week and gravely injured others, it sparked fear and outrage and bewilderment around the country. Calls to action, people digging into their positions, others calling for a coming together. On Thursday night, Vermont's Department of Public Safety revealed that it had been investigating a threat towards a high school in Vermont, and it arrested an 18-year-old named Jack Sawyer, who had allegedly written in a diary his desire to cause mass casualties at his former high school, Fairhaven Union, and had expressed his support for the Florida shooting in communication with a friend. That friend reported his words, and police took action. They arrested Sawyer on the charges of attempted aggravated murder, attempted first-degree murder, and attempted aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. Sawyer has pleaded not guilty. Governor Phil Scott said he was jolted by the arrest and how close to home it hit. But for many people working in schools, they think about these things a lot, and they worry and plan how to keep their students safe, how to identify students who are at risk, how to help them, and when is it time to alert authorities? How do you protect your community and protect the privacy of a student who has not committed a crime? How do you make sure you're connecting with students and bringing them back into the fold? What if they resist? What do you do? Today, we're going to talk about those questions. Elijah Hawks is co-principal at Randolph Union Middle and High Schools, and he's on the line with us today. Hello, Principal Hawks. Nice to talk with you again.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for the opportunity.
And Rob Evans is the Vermont School Safety Liaison Officer for the Agency of Education and the Department of Public Safety. He's also a retired Vermont State Police captain and a parent. Rob Evans, nice to have you on the program as well today.
Thanks for having me as well.
Elijah Hawks, you reflected on this in some writing, and you've obviously been thinking about the situation in Florida even before we heard about a potential averted situation in Vermont. What were your immediate thoughts? I know this isn't the first time you've had to think about it.
Right. We had an incident here in Randolph about 4 years ago when two of our students were. There was a law enforcement intervention and a parental intervention that led to them not being in our school for a full year. So, we've done some thinking about this. This particular school shooting, for me, I was on my way actually to the airport Wednesday afternoon, and so I listened to a lot of it unfold in the after-school hours on the radio and then actually in the plane, and was very moved, of course, by all that I saw, and wrote a letter to my colleagues upon landing in JFK to tell them that my thoughts were with them and that I trusted them, and that I trusted them to say and do the right things with students, and that the most important thing we can do is be close to them and know them and find security through our relationships and our strong attachments with students, parents, and community members, in addition to taking common sense precautions in terms of more traditional outward-facing security.
How was what you wrote received? What did you hear back from your community?
Oh, I heard some positive reflections from teachers and from others. I think there's a sense that you can feel a sense of helplessness when you encounter trauma, whether you're an infant, a small child, or a person of any age. And so it's important to know what are your skills, what are your choices, what are your resources, and how can you apply them to make the situation better. And to remind educators that their strengths are in the interpersonal, social, emotional realm. Building rapport with kids so that they can learn, to remind people of those skills and those strengths. I think people find it empowering, and it's a reminder that the most important thing to do the next day is to look into the eyes of the children that you're with, greet them, know them, ask the kind question, and see how they respond, and then respond accordingly to whatever their emotional reality is at the time.
Rob Evans, what about for you? I imagine as the Vermont School Safety Liaison Officer, when you hear about a shooting even in another state, there are probably some not just thoughts you have, but perhaps some protocol for the state to be on alert or just to be aware of things that are happening. And I'm curious about, you know, how it felt to get that news for you and then what you did.
Yeah, Jane, it's always shocking to hear that there's yet another senseless act of violence that's impacted, our school communities. And it often makes us reflect personally about how safe our individual school communities are. But I couldn't agree more that, you know, the first step in ensuring a open and welcoming and safe and secure educational environment is those personal relationships that are associated with parents, with teachers, with students and coworkers and those types of things. When we have that type of community where folks have an ability to voice a concern about a behavior or current behavior that may have a negative impact on our school, that's where we get into preventing these things before they can ever happen. But certainly now, as our schools, I'm sure across Vermont, are looking to refine their individual security procedures and protocols, and taking an opportunity to look at enhancing those if there aren't some enhancements that need to be made.
Yeah, Rob Evans, your phone goes in and out a little bit, so I'm not sure everybody got all of your words, but yeah, that idea of reflecting and looking at protocol, but also echoing what you heard from Elijah Hawks on getting to know students and really working on those relationships. And Principal Hawks, I'm curious, you know, you brought that up, you brought it up in your writing, you've brought it up in the way that you try to operate. Is it possible to know all of your students, to know when something is going on? I mean, you certainly don't always have insight into the inner workings of people's minds.
Of course. You're right, Jane, and that's where it's important to have relationships with all kinds of people in the community. The family, the family's neighbors, law enforcement, the local store owner, the local gun shop salesperson. It's important to have relationships with as many people as possible so that the information can be shared when it needs to be shared about a child who may be in crisis, who may be feeling extraordinary stress, and who may need support.
And you mentioned that there has been a situation in Randolph and, you know, being respectful of the need for privacy. Can you talk a little bit about how you dealt with the fact that a couple of students did get suspended from school? There was police intervention, and how you would address that and school safety while also trying to make sure that you're keeping kids who are experiencing some difficulties sort of in the community?
Mm-hmm. Well, in the very moments and days after it transpired, we were alerted on a Sunday evening by law enforcement that some students were going to be detained and not allowed to come to school, and I believe that they were alerted by a family member of a concern, and that there can tell us something about the importance of relationships in the home, the importance of parents having the online passwords of their young people so that they can provide safety and oversight in terms of online networks. But that's a sort of aside. What I was going to say was that we made an effort to communicate directly and appropriately with the entire parent community and with the entire student and faculty community as soon as we had enough facts and information to share. So we simultaneously sent a phone message home to the parent community at the same time that we convened two assemblies, one with the middle school and one with the high school, and that was where we shared some information with students and with faculty and with parents at the same time. And then there were multiple meeting forums, of course, after school and in the evening hours for parents, faculty, and community, and we relied heavily on our advisory program during the school day as a venue to continue conversations with students, and of course lean heavily on the counseling and school support staff that's here to have follow-up conversations with kids in certain peer groups who may be having stronger reactions than others. And then a year later, the emphasis is on working with social service agencies, families, and law enforcement to ensure that if the child is to be returning to our school, that we have some very effective restorative justice practice in place so that there can be some healing before there's reentry to the community.
So to that point, the restorative justice, was that a key part of this, that not only are students allowed back into the school community and that that's necessary, but that there has to be some accounting and some accounting and grappling within that community of people who are affected?
Yeah, absolutely. And restorative practice gives us some pretty simple but powerful language and concepts to use in those moments. The idea is that if there's been harm done to a community, that harm comes with needs and obligations, and different people may have different needs and different obligations, and the conversation needs to surface what those needs and obligations are, and we're all implicated. Some of us have different roles in making some repair, but there's a fabric there that that's an interweaving of relationships. So there needs to be some repair. The harm needs to be acknowledged. The needs need to be acknowledged. And then there needs to be follow-up to make sure that whatever is agreed to actually takes place. So there's a role for positional authority. There's a role for law enforcement. And there's a role for very strict traditional consequences at times, whether it's suspension or expulsion. But there's an especially important role for repair. And if that's neglected, then, of course, things go unrepaired and things get worse.
Rob Evans, we have you back and hopefully on a better line. And I'm curious, as a school safety liaison officer, what do you think about this idea of grappling with people who, young people who are maybe dealing with violence, maybe dealing with police issues, and then having a way to try to bring them back in so that they're not isolated permanently, but that they have to make an accounting of their actions. They have to talk with the people who are affected.
Yeah, that's the fine line associated with doing what we call the behavioral threat assessment process, is looking to the credibility of the individual threats that some folks may be experiencing, but also understanding there's a sensitivity and a confidentiality associated with students, attending school, that this can't be hearsay information. We can't be ringing people out with the wash based upon third-person type of information. This has to be credible, vetted, investigated information, before law enforcement can take action and the individual safety and security actions can be taken. And that's that fine line between confidentiality and then actually being able to move from a law enforcement investigative standpoint.
How do we manage that line, though? I mean, you think about this young person in Vermont who was arrested and is being charged. If convicted, he could face a lengthy jail sentence. He didn't actually commit a violent act. So, I think that there's this sense of you should tell somebody, you need to tell somebody. If it's a credible threat, it will be assessed. On the other hand, there's a fear that legal action may be taken, that, you could be, if you're, for example, a student or a parent reporting something, you don't want to be responsible for ruining someone's life, but you also want to be responsible for protecting your kids and your community. And that is a very difficult line.
Yeah, and I see it come back to that old, response methodology about if you see something, say something. And we may not have the entire story or thread of information, but I think we all have to take the approach that that thread may be a variety of different threads that can be put together to either confirm or deny a threat and the credibility of the threat. And the problem becomes when folks don't think that it's important enough to share, that they don't think that this just isn't relevant. It's more important to share those types of conversations and concerns so that, professionals can take a look at that and determine whether there's a credibility to it or not.
I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're talking with Elijah Hawks, co-principal at Randolph Union Middle and High Schools, and with Rob Evans, the Vermont School Safety Liaison Officer for the Agency of Education and the Department of Public Safety. We're having a conversation about identifying students in crisis and at risk, students who separate from the fold. And we're looking as well simultaneously at safety and security in Vermont schools. We know that lockdown drills are common now, even in preschools and on up through high school. How else are schools looking at safety and security? Not just things like security protocol, locks on the doors, but even things, as Principal Hawks has been talking about, the idea of safety in knowing who your community is, identifying students who may be experiencing some problems. Fran in Weybridge says, as a former teacher, a grandparent of three school-aged children, and the parent of a teacher in a local school, I worry about the safety of my family members and everyone who lives in Vermont. The recent close call in Fairhaven Union High School is chilling. The availability of guns is what can turn an angry person into a mass killer. Let's take Governor Scott at his word and start talking about common sense gun control. If we can come together and have the difficult conversations needed to tackle this heartbreaking problem, I'm sure we can make progress. And let's go to Christopher, who's calling in from Johnson, Vermont. Hi, Christopher. Go right ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm just wondering, we've been talking a lot about, even this morning, about loneliness and the separation in between people and how much that affects mental health. And my question was that why are we talking about the perpetrators in a criminalistic way when perhaps we might be more effective at stopping this problem if we talk about it in a mental health way? I'll take the answer offline. Thank you.
Christopher, thanks for the call. Elijah Hawks, what do you think about that?
Well, I think educators need to absolutely consider the mental health and the emotional well-being of the children that we work with, and that needs to be the primary framework that we're using when we talk about young people. And if we're partnering with law enforcement, we're partnering with law enforcement and using that same language. But I think it's important not to criminalize a young person at all unnecessarily. I'm not sure if that gets exactly what the caller was referring to.
Yeah, you say unnecessarily. So there, I mean, obviously there are times, there certainly are times when people commit crimes and there is criminality. And I think people would bristle at the idea that, for example, you wouldn't treat the shooter in Florida as a criminal now. And I don't think that's what Mark is saying. But that idea of, you know, how do you address emotional needs first is one that Elijah Hawks, you've talked about before. And Rob Evans, Elijah said we have to partner in that kind of language with law enforcement. You come from a police background. You were a Vermont State Police captain for 23 years. You were also part of the tactical team who responded to the shootings that ended at Essex Elementary School in 2006. How do you think about that idea of safety and security and emotional and mental well-being?
Yeah, Jen, I think it's, you know, I look at it from a community caretaking approach and not necessarily all encompassing in mental health. When you look at, you know, an open and welcoming, safe and secure school environment, it comes back to culture and climate in the school. And there are a variety of behaviors that can have a negative impact, from hazing and harassment to bullying, you know, to access to guns and those types of things. It's not and shouldn't be focused specifically on mental health related issues. But I look at it coming back to a community caretaking approach and relationship building and rapport building in all of our schools is the best way to keep our kids and faculty and staff safe in our schools.
Nonetheless, while you're doing that work, do schools need to beef up their security protocol? Do they need to put more locks on doors? Do we need to have metal detectors in Vermont schools?
Yeah, great question. I will tell you, since 1999, you know, Vermont has been focused on enhancing our level to what we call an all hazards approach to safety and security in Vermont, and not just focusing on, you know, what we're hearing in the news about active shooter or violent intruder, but taking a look at all things that may have a negative impact on our schools, from bus accidents to bullying to incidents of assaults that take place in school to heart attacks of staff members, anything that may have a negative impact on our school. We have been taking an all-hazards approach on those types of emergency preparedness efforts since 1999. And in 2016, we formalized the process between the Agency of Education and the Department of Public Safety to provide schools across the state of Vermont with best practices and contemporary standards about how folks can enhance their level of emergency preparedness, and really trying to stay away from things that detract from an open and welcoming environment, because there are different levels of security that can really provide those types of environments without having to build, you know, fences and gates and those types of things. There are methodologies that we can put in place that provide different levels of security in our schools.
Can you give me an example of that? Because an all hazards approach, I think, makes sense to people who are doing this work, but sounds a little bit vague, I think, to people who are thinking, what does that even mean? And so, you know, that idea of creating safety protocol that don't necessarily include fences or, you know, double doors.
Yeah, so I look at, you know, it's starting from, you know, the outside of the school and looking at, do we have appropriate wayfinding that sends visitors to the main entrance of the school? And are those main entrances and access to our schools controlled during normal business operations? And when folks come inside the school, do we have a host guest policy and a visitor management policy that we just don't allow folks to walk freely through our schools? And do all of our schools have internal locking mechanisms so that all of our classrooms and common spaces that everybody can get into a lockdown if a lockdown is called, and looking at different types of methodologies that if we're in a lockdown, are we Are we putting ourselves in a position to be safe within those classrooms? And are we looking at evacuation and those types of things, different types of response methodologies to keep kids safe and faculty and staff safe, no matter what threat they may be exposed to?
We got a note from Sue who says, having students and staff use restorative practices on an ongoing basis can build community and help develop skills to manage emotion and relationships. It's enormously helpful to prevent disciplinary incidents and harm and keep people integrated in their communities. And let's go to Julie, who's calling in from Troy. Hi, Julie. Go right ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've been a teacher for 27 years, and I see now more than ever the need to utilize our school services and our human resources that might be available in our communities to bring together all of those pieces that our families and our children need. Counselors, the Department of Children and Families, drug and alcohol counseling, other things that families really need, but, you know, might be out of their reach or out of their ability to get their children or themselves into as a family for family counseling. And I'd like to see if we could bring all of those services together within the school communities and see if that helps to support some of our families.
Julie, thanks for your call. I appreciate that. Let's get a couple more perspectives in here before we return to our guests. Susan is calling in from St. Albans. Hi, Susan. Go right ahead.
Hi there. I'm calling. I'm a drama teacher at BFA St. Albans.
Yeah.
Do I have you? I was cutting out earlier.
Yeah, we have you, Susan. I'm glad you're still here. Go right ahead.
Yeah. So I run a theater for social change group after school, and it's a group that just explores different social issues, and then we create scenes and perform them back to the school as a talking tool. And the other day, actually on Wednesday, at the same time as the whole thing was unfolding in Parkland, unbeknownst to us, we were all meeting and the theme or topic of school shooter came up, and all the students started talking about the first time they had encountered school shooters, and they were talking about Sandy Hook. And then they turned to me and said, what was your first time? And being of a different generation, obviously, I just said, you know, when I was in high school, we didn't have this as an issue. And their response was, well, why do we have this as an issue? And what do you mean you didn't have it? And they were just really shocked. And I didn't really know how to address why it's an issue now and it wasn't for me. And so I guess I'm just tossing that topic out onto the table for you all.
Yeah, Susan, I appreciate you sharing that perspective and anecdote, and so interesting to think of the perspective of students today and how shocked they might be at the differences that previous generations experienced. Let's get one more in here from Jeff, who's calling in from Burlington, and then we'll turn back to our guests.
Yes.
Hi, Jeff. Go ahead.
Let's get one more in here.
Jeff, turn off your radio and listen on your phone, and you'll be able to respond to us. Go right ahead. All right, we're going to try to come back to Jeff, but Susan brought that idea up of how do you tell students, you know, why this is an issue today when it might not have been for their parents? How do parents address this? And, you know, Elijah and Rob, I think you both think about this a lot because you are trying to think about creating communities that are safe and are places where kids can learn and be themselves and be safe. So, Elijah, what do you think? How do you address why this is happening today and then how to deal with it?
Well, I think Susan's asking a very good question. I think we have to look to Congress in Washington, D.C. and ask our senators why there's been a moratorium on debate and research. There's been a moratorium on research, not just debate, into guns and their effects on public health in this country. So there's a dearth of data. So Susan is right to feel like this is a bit of a mystery, and the kids are right to ask why. And it's hard for teachers sometimes to answer because there's been some prohibition on researching the impact of guns on public health in the United States. I find Nicholas Kristof's recent piece with a lot of data in the New York Times to be useful. There's some interesting graphics comparing 1991, when perhaps Susan was in high school and certainly when I was in high school, and today, and how conceal and carry laws have changed, how open carry of handguns has changed, and how open carry of long guns has changed in just 10 years. And that might be something Susan's students would be interested in.
And what about you, Rob? What do you think about this? You know, how do you address the modern era we live in? Is it all guns? Is it also emotional well-being? I mean, there's got to be a combination, right?
Yeah, I don't think you can point to one or the other. I think it's all of those things. But like Elijah said, I think it's critically important that we are having these conversations, however difficult they may be. I think we get through them in a public and an open and honest dialogue about the situations and the things that we face each and every day. I think it doesn't do anybody any service if we hide from it. I think there's a power if we're going to talk about it and talk about it as a community and how the community is going to move forward.
Let's go to another call here, Carrie in Colchester. Hi, Carrie. Go right ahead.
Hi. My comment is in reference to the gentleman that spoke about teachers, how they have to have better relationships with their students, understand where they're coming from. My challenge to that is we have tasked educators to be so much more than just educators. It becomes unreasonable for us to assume that they can actually fill that role. I would like to suggest that we approach it from the opposite direction and work on sensible gun regulations. Why can a 14-year-old buy a semi-automatic rifle? We don't allow people to drink until they're 21 or smoke until they're 21. Why can't we move the gun issue to age 21.
Yeah, Carrie, thanks for your call. I appreciate hearing that. And certainly guns are a huge topic and a huge issue in this and a huge conversation when you talk about somebody who wants to do damage, wants to injure and kill people, and then has access to a gun and access to a lot of ammunition. And, you know, that in a very short time can lead to massive disaster, as we have certainly seen. Lots of people calling for gun control here. Rob Evans, is that something that you think is a worthy conversation to have right now? We're even hearing it in a very pointed and poignant way from survivors of the attack in Florida.
Yeah, I think it's an all hands on deck approach. And I think we all saw Governor Scott in his press conference last week that I think every part of this process should be open and debated. And it's a conversation about gun control. It's a conversation about access to guns. It's a conversation about mental health. It's a conversation about hazing, harassment, and bullying. It's all these approaches that we have to be and provide opportunities for conversation and again, a pathway forward.
Let's go to Sophia calling in from Putney. Hi, Sophia.
Hello.
Hi. Your thoughts?
Hi. I had a comment to add to that. But I just was wanting, I would like to see the conversation broaden a bit to looking at this beyond a mental health issue, recognizing that a lot of people experience mental illness, and yet there's a very clear pattern with these kinds of shootings that the vast majority of these perpetrators tend to be cis white men. And so I'm wondering about the conversation about toxic masculinity and white supremacy in this culture. So you could speak to that.
Yeah, Sophia, thanks for your call. Elijah Hawks, how do you think about that? I mean, we're talking about, you know, not in every case, certainly, but in so many of the cases, the preponderance of cases, a white cis hetero man or boy.
Well, I think our caller is asking a very important question. As a father of two boys, it's certainly what defines masculinity and strength in our culture is something that certainly needs to be interrogated at the earliest of ages. And I think the violence and revenge narratives that we have available to us as young men also need to be interrogated. I think the caller is absolutely right to ask the question, and I think that it needs to be another topic, like Rob is saying, of the multiple conversations that we need to be having.
But then we hear from an earlier caller, you can't expect teachers to be doing all of this work while also teaching mathematics or even, you know, teaching social studies. And so how do we have too many expectations on our teachers?
Well, yes and no. I think yes in that teachers are asked to do an extraordinary amount in our culture, in our society, and they're easily stigmatized and they're easily revered, and it's hard for people to find a middle ground in terms of supporting teachers as human beings who are doing a really difficult job with other people's children for 6 to 7 to 8 to 9 hours every day of their lives. But I think it's not too much to ask schools to personalize their curriculum and interventions and to interject political content into the classroom, whether it's math, science, social studies, English, or the arts. There's a space for, especially in adolescence, but I think as early as my five-year-old in kindergarten, for conversations where difficult issues are raised and where moral, ethical, and political questions are explored with students. I also think that schools can do a lot to support teachers when they open these spaces up for conversations. We have a math teacher at my school who just a few days ago created a space at the beginning of class for a personal kind of check-in, and a student said something that caused quite a stir. And so then the question is, what support does that teacher have in the moment, and what support does that teacher and student have in the hours and days afterwards to make sure that that comment is followed up on, and the student and the teacher in the class get the support that they need? And that's where guidance counselors and administrators, social workers, and others who are attuned to what's going on in the classroom and ready to deploy to support the classroom are very important. If we want to ask teachers to have these conversations, we need to be ready to provide support.
We got a note,
Jane,
from...
If I can follow
yeah,
up.
Yeah, go right ahead, Rob. Let me just read this note from Peter in the meantime, and Rob, I'd love your reflections as well. But Peter says, why not hire enough psychologists to join the staff of the school so that every kid has a weekly appointment with a psychologist at the school whose chief mission it is to keep that student as happy as can be? They'd also be trained to identify red flags and warning signs of potential violent behavior. And go ahead, Rob Evans.
No, I just wanted to get back to the impacts that that this all has on our teaching community as well. And I tell you, I'm so impressed with the dialogue that I'm hearing and seeing from principals and superintendents across the state that really are trying to get out in front of these types of conversations, not only just with their faculty and staff and their students, but with the parents population as well, recognizing and identifying that these are issues and their willingness to identify them and talk about them and talk about how difficult it is to get through some of these things. I think that's very therapeutic, and I'm just so impressed with our school executive leadership teams that really are taking this as an opportunity for learning for all of us.
You know, Rob, as we talk about this, I think that there are people who are really glad to be having conversations about this, to be learning about what schools are doing, to see principals like Elijah Hawks thinking about this, working with kids, making sure that you're trying to keep everyone in the fold. On the other hand, you know, I think the situation in Fairhaven reminds people that there are always the possibilities for somebody to slip through the cracks or for this kind of thing to happen. We got a note from Chip who says, what about rural schools that are not so close to a town and don't have a specific police force? The police response time could be a real issue in the overall outcome. And you just hear from so many parents right now who just feel this deep fear. You know, this could happen in my school, and no matter how much preparation there is, it could be so deadly. You know, you hear the call to ban automatic weapons, which are banned, but semi-automatic, to do more gun control. I mean, Rob, no matter what we do, in some ways, this could still happen in Vermont.
Yeah, and I want to highlight that, you know, in my professional opinion, schools in Vermont are safe. And you're right, there always are those chances that something unforeseen or wasn't predicted could certainly happen. But there are an awful lot of people that are working extremely hard each and every day to ensure that every student, when they get on the bus and they come to school and walk into their classrooms, are going to be safe throughout that given day. And certainly there are going to be times where we just can't prevent bad people from doing bad things. But there are folks that have committed a lifetime's worth of work to make sure that Vermont kids are safe coming to school each and every day.
Well, this is a piece of the conversation, and certainly there will be more to come, including questions and discussions about gun control. There are bills in the legislature this year, so we're not having that conversation today, but I appreciate the thoughtful approach to today's conversation. Elijah Hawks is a co-principal at Randolph Union Middle and High Schools. Rob Evans is Vermont School Safety Liaison Officer for the Agency of Education and the Department of Public Safety. He's also a retired state police captain. Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I also want to invite listeners, you know, this is, as I said, a part of the conversation. So if there are conversations that you'd like to be having around these issues, around resiliency, around guns, tell us what perspective you're coming from, what you think we should be talking about. We're going to be talking about a lot of it in the coming months, as we always do, and we would love to hear from you. You can write to Vermont Edition at vpr.net.